We are looking together at the first book of Kings. The first book of Kings, we're still in chapter 1, near the end. And as we go through the history of Israel together, we learn some very important lessons. Lessons that are principles for us that we can use in our walk with God. And that's why we're looking at it. The things that happened to Israel were put in this book by God to teach us. We are looking at chapter 1 from verse 38. David had just commanded that Solomon should be escorted to the spring of Gihon, which is near the pool of Siloam, and there he was to be anointed and proclaimed king. So we pick up the narrative in verse 38. So Zadok the priest, Nathan the prophet, Benaiah the son of Jehoiada, the Cherethites and the Pelethites went down and had Solomon ride on King David's mule and took him to Gihon. Then Zadok the priest took a horn of oil from the tabernacle and anointed Solomon. And they blew the horn, and all the people said, "Long live King Solomon!" And all the people went up after him. And the people played the flutes and rejoiced with great joy, so that the earth seemed to split with their sound. Now Adoniah and all the guests who were with him heard it as they finished eating. And when Joab heard the sound of the horn, he said, "Why is the city in such a noisy uproar?" While he was still speaking, there came Jonathan, the son of Abiathar, the priest. And Adoniah said to him, "Come in, for you are a prominent man, and bring good news." Then Jonathan answered and said to Adoniah, "No, our Lord King David has made Solomon king. The king has sent with him Zadok the priest, Nathan the prophet, Benaiah the son of Jehoiada, the Cherethites and the Pelethites, and they have made him ride on the king's mule. So Zadok the priest and Nathan the prophet have anointed him king at Gihon. And they have gone up from there rejoicing, so that the city is in an uproar. This is the noise that you have heard. Also, Solomon sits on the throne of the kingdom." Let's pause there. We saw from the beginning of this chapter that Adoniah, the son of Haggith, son of David, the fourth eldest, exalted himself, saying, "I will be king." He had special ceremony, he had a feast, and it was more or less, as far as Adoniah was concerned, it was more or less sewn up. It was a done thing, a done deal. But Nathan the prophet knew very well that it was God's will that Solomon should be the king. So he came to Bathsheba and he asked her to go in and tell David what was happening. And David, although he was old, still had all his faculties around him. And he immediately appointed Nathan the prophet, Zadok the priest, and Benaiah, his new general, to take the Cherethites and the Pelethites and escort Solomon down to the brook, the spring of Gihon. Cherethites, Pelethites. The Cherethites were probably Cretans from the island of Crete. The Pelethites, believe it or not, were Philistines who had become true to God, true to David, who had followed David in his exile, and when David was made king, they joined David. They left their own people, they left their own country, they allied themselves to King David. And they proved, these Cherethites and Pelethites, to be the most loyal bodyguard that any king could have wished. So they took Solomon down. Now when Adoniah had exalted himself to be king, the people of Israel stood back a bit. They hesitated. "Wait a minute," they thought, "something's not right here. It doesn't add up." They were hesitating because David had already said in a public assembly, "God has chosen Solomon, my son, to be king." Well, now they wanted to know whether things had changed, and until they knew, they were not going to do anything. But when David took this decisive action, all the people saw that everything was in order. Solomon was still going to be the king. And so the coronation, this pseudo coronation of Adonijah, fell apart. They had just finished their banquet when they were celebrating Adonijah's kingship, self-appointed kingship. And it was then that Jonathan came in, verse 42. And they said, "Oh, good, you usually come with good news." "No, not this time," said Jonathan. "This time I've got bad news for you. You're not the king, Adonijah. Solomon is." David's action neatly eclipsed Adonijah's presumption. But you notice David did not go chasing after his son with an army. He just asserted God's choice. And we find that Solomon himself, in all this, waited for God to vindicate his choice. David says in one of his psalms, Psalm 57 and verse 2, "I will cry unto God Most High, unto God that performs all things for me." And Solomon had the same spirit. "I will just leave it in God's hands. When it comes to my calling," this is what Solomon was thinking, "when it comes to my calling, I can leave my future safely in the hands of God. No one can stop it. When God calls, nobody can get in the way. If they do, the Lord moves them out of the way." In Psalm 75, we get this truth again repeated for us. Psalm 75, verses 6 and 7. I'll read from verse 5. Psalm 75 from verse 5. "Do not lift up your horn on high. Do not speak with a stiff neck. For exaltation comes neither from the east, nor from the west, nor from the south. But God is the judge. He puts down one and exalts another." That's what Daniel records concerning Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar thought that he himself had risen to his position of glory through his own power. But at the end of it, Nebuchadnezzar had to confess, after God had finished dealing with him, "God does according to his will in the armies of heaven and on earth." Solomon sat on the throne. Verse 46, this is what Jonathan says in verse 46. "Also, Solomon sits on the throne of the kingdom." We find that this was the second time that they made Solomon king. Sometimes it needs to be repeated. It happened with Saul, king of Israel. Samuel said, "You see the one whom God has chosen to be king?" But there were certain people that despised Saul, son of Kish. So after a tremendous victory over Nahash the Ammonite, when he delivered the people of Jabesh Gilead from the siege of Nahash, Samuel said, "Let's go to Gilgal and let us renew the kingdom there." It wasn't making him king again, but it was reasserting his right to be king. And this is what was happening here. David reasserted Solomon's right. He had said, if you read in 1 Chronicles chapter 23 and 1 Chronicles chapter 29, you'll find that David reminds the people of this, that Solomon was the one that God had chosen. 1 Chronicles chapter 23, verse 1. "So when David was old and full of days, he made his son Solomon king over Israel, and he gathered together all the leaders of Israel with the priests and the Levites." And then if we go to chapter 29 of 1 Chronicles, again we see David reasserts Solomon. Then, first Chronicles 29, verse 22. "So they ate and drank before the Lord with great gladness on that day. And they made Solomon the son of David king the second time, and anointed him before the Lord to be the leader, and Zadok to be priest. This was the second time that we're reading about here. Solemnly ratifying God's choice. And then Jonathan went on to say in verse 47, and moreover the king's servants, we're back at 1 Kings chapter 1, and moreover the king's servants have gone to bless our Lord King David, saying, may God make the name of Solomon better than your name, and may he make his throne greater than your throne. Then the king bowed himself on the bed. Also the king said thus, blessed be the Lord God of Israel, who has given one to sit on my throne this day, while my eyes see it. Better. Fancy, were they really putting David down? No, they weren't. They were saying, may his throne be even greater than yours, on a foundation of peace. David's throne was established through much war, through much conflict. He had much to subdue, much hostilities to subdue from within and from without the nation. But when they say, may God make your son's throne better than yours, it is because Shlomo comes from the word shalom, and he was going to be a peaceful king. He would not need to go to war. David had done it all for him. God, through David, had subdued all the enemies, and now Solomon, as it were, had the kingdom given to him on a silver platter. And the king David obviously did not take it amiss, because he blessed God. He thanked God that he lived to see the day when God had given him a successor. There was a further reason why David blessed God, because God had promised to him that from the fruit of his loins one day, one of his descendants would turn out to be the Messiah. And when David saw his successor Solomon, he thought, God is keeping his promise, and one day one of Solomon's descendants will turn out to be the Messiah of our people. That's why the Messiah is called Ben David, Mashiach Ben David, the son of David. What was the reaction of the guests? Verse 49, so all the guests who were with Adonijah were afraid and arose, and each one went his way. Now Adonijah was afraid of Solomon, so he arose and went and took hold of the horns of the altar. And it was told Solomon, saying, indeed Adonijah is afraid of King Solomon, for look, he has taken hold of the horns of the altar, saying, let King Solomon swear to me today that he will not put his servant to death with the sword. Then Solomon said, if he proves himself a worthy man, not one hair of him shall fall to the earth. But if wickedness is found in him, he shall die. So King Solomon sent them to bring him down from the altar, and he came and fell down before King Solomon, and Solomon said to him, go to your house. Adonijah was afraid. He was afraid now of the one that he had despised and that he opposed. He had not invited Solomon to his coronation banquet. He was afraid now of being accused of treason, and what he did was to run to the altar. The altar at that time was in Gibeon, in Benjamin, in the tribe of Benjamin, some miles away from Jerusalem to the north. It was the altar of sacrifice that Moses had built at God's direction. It was still being used in the town of Gibeon, where the tabernacle of Moses was still standing hundreds of years after they had entered the promised land. He lay hold on the horns of the altar of sacrifice. It was a symbolic gesture. When someone was afraid of their life and there was no human refuge left, they could run to the altar and grab one of the horns of that altar. It was the place of sacrifice. It was the meeting place of man and God. This is where men met God, through the sacrifice, through the medium of the sacrifice that was offered. And holding on to that altar, he was saying, I plead for God's protection. And God allowed it, except for one case. If there was a murderer would find no protection even there. He could be taken from the altar and executed for having committed murder. So Adoniah lay hold on the horns of the altar, and they brought a message back to Jerusalem to King Solomon. Please spare me, swear to me, let King Solomon swear to me today that he will not put his servant to death with the sword. That reminds us, doesn't it, of the parable Yeshua told of the unforgiving servant. In Matthew chapter 18, we read about a king who wanted to reckon with his servants, and he found one who owed him 10,000 talents. That's a tremendous sum of money, millions of dollars. And the man had nothing to pay, so the king said, all right, sell him, sell all his family into slavery, sell his possessions, and let him make payment. The king was still waiting to see how that servant would behave that had been forgiven so much. We read about him that he found a fellow servant that owed him 100 pence. That's about 3 months' wages. 100 pence. He took him by the throat saying, pay me what you owe. And this servant, this second servant, fell before him and he said, have mercy on me and I will pay you all. This time, it was feasible. He could have paid it all. No. He sent him into jail till he should pay what he owed. But really, when the poor man is in jail, he can't possibly earn anything to pay his debt. So this unforgiving servant was really cutting his nose to spite his own face. When the servants heard about it, they told the king, and the king called him back. He said, you wicked servant, I forgave you such a vast debt because you asked me, should you not have had compassion on your fellow servant as I had on you? The king was angry and delivered him to the tormentors till he should pay what he owed, and that meant never. The unforgiving servant. So we see here also Adoniah pleading for mercy. And what Solomon did in response was, I will give him a conditional reprieve. Really, what Solomon was saying was, his character will determine his fate. It's your character, mine, that will determine our fate, our standing before God. It's not what we say, it's our character. God is looking and watching to see, are we true in our hearts towards him? Solomon gave him a conditional reprieve. He put him on his good behavior. In Matthew chapter 7, the Lord Yeshua says in verse 20, therefore, by their fruits you will know them. By their fruits you will know them. And Solomon was saying, I'll give him a chance to prove himself. I'll give him a fair opportunity to vindicate his honesty, his integrity. If he proves himself a worthy man, not one hair of him shall fall to the earth, but if wickedness is found in him, he shall die. Well, he came and bowed before King Solomon, which meant that he was acknowledging now that Solomon was the rightful king. And then Solomon said to him, go to your house. That means, go home, lead a private life, don't meddle anymore with the affairs of the kingdom. That's really what he was saying. Go home, you're free, but don't interfere anymore. Now, in chapter 2, we have David's dying charge to Solomon, verses 1 through 9. And there's a problem here that we have to look at. Now the days of David drew near that he should die, and he charged Solomon his son, saying, I go the way of all the earth. Be strong, therefore, and prove yourself a man. And keep the charge of the Lord your God, to walk in his ways, to keep his statutes, his commandments, his judgments, and his testimonies, as it is written in the law of Moses, that you may prosper in all that you do and wherever you turn, that the Lord may fulfill his word which he spoke concerning me, saying, if your sons take heed to their way, to walk before me in truth, with all their heart and with all their soul, he said, you shall not lack a man on the throne of Israel. As Jacob charged Joseph before he died, gave him his dying instructions, so we have it here. Shaul also, when he wrote to Timothy, he said, this charge I commit to you, son Timothy, that by it you may war a good warfare. He was going the way of all the earth. That reminds us of the universal sentence of death on mankind. But do you notice? He doesn't say, I'm finished. When one of my friends was dying in hospital, Saul Fry, he said, I'm finished. But the believer doesn't say that. He says, I go the way of all the earth. It is a way, it's not the end. Though he leads in Psalm 23, David says, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil, for thou art with me. Thy rod and thy staff, they comfort me. Now, David says, be strong, therefore, and prove yourself a man. That is, be strong in faith, be strong in purpose, etc. I'm going, Solomon. I'm no longer there as your prop. Now it will appear what kind of a man you are. People sometimes are worse, turn for the worse, when the ones they relied on are taken away from them. As long as the people are there, they're okay. They're on the rails. But once that good influence has been removed, then they show what they really are. There's one of the kings of Judah like that. His name was Joash. As long as Jehoiada, the high priest, was alive, he followed the advice of Jehoiada and he lived a godly life. But when Jehoiada was dead, he turned to idols. And he showed what he really was like inside, behind the mask. So what David is saying to Solomon, now Solomon, you're on your own, you're on your mettle. Prove to yourself, to God, and to all others, that you are a worthy man. Be strong. In Psalm 27, wait on the Lord, be of good courage, and he shall strengthen your heart. Wait, I say, on the Lord. And we're told to be steadfast, unmovable, always abounding in the work of the Lord. He also told him to keep the charge of the Lord his God. And by that is the same charge that God gave to Joshua. But more particularly, what David said to Solomon his son. 1 Chronicles chapter 28. He's referring to that charge he gave him in public. 1 Chronicles chapter 28. Verse 9. 1 Chronicles 28 and verse 9. This is the charge he's referring to. As for you, my son Solomon, know the God of your father, and serve him with a loyal heart and with a willing mind. For the Lord searches all hearts and understands all the intent of the thoughts. If you seek him, he will be found by you. That if you forsake him, he will cast you off forever. That was the charge that he's speaking about. Keep the charge of the Lord. And how are we to determine where are we going to have this charge enlarged upon? He says, to keep his statutes, his commandments, his just judgments, and his testimonies as it is written in the law of Moses. In other words, the law of Moses is a code for holy living, and we ignore it to our peril. There are lots of people who get confused on this point and who think that now that God has made a new covenant with us through the Messiah, that the law no longer applies to the believer. That is a total fallacy. And people who believe like that are going to get into trouble. Let's hope that at the very lowest they are being inconsistent, and that they are really obeying the law even though they say they're not. Because in the second covenant, God says, I will take my laws and write them in their hearts and in their minds. He doesn't say, goodbye law. No, he takes the law that was originally written on tablets of stone, and now he writes them on the tablets of the heart. So it's even closer. It's inside us now. It's not outside. That's how important the moral law is. I'm speaking about the moral law in particular. The statutes, his commandments, his judgments, his testimonies. They are all meant to guide us to keep the charge of the law. They are meant to instruct us how we can do so. What is right in the sight of God? What is wrong? So he's encouraging Solomon to do this. Not only that, but he says, as the result of it, you will prosper in all that you do and wherever you turn. When we keep God's word keeps us. So that the thing we keep turns out to be keeping us. It's a reflex relationship with each other. And the word prosper means deal prudently. The book of Psalms opens up, blessed is the man that walketh not in the counsel of the ungodly, nor standeth in the way of sinners, nor sitteth in the seat of the scornful, but his delight is in the law of the Lord, and in his law doth he meditate day and night. That's in the Psalms. We must take all the word of God. We can't say some of it is out of date. Who's to be the judge then of what is not out of date? Take it all, and then you're safe. He also says here that he's to do it with his heart and with his soul. In verse 4, that the Lord may fulfill his word which he spoke concerning me, saying, if your sons take heed to their way to walk before me in truth with all their heart and with all their soul. Shema Israel. It is the Shema again. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your might. Heart and soul. That is the manner of our walk with God. It's got to be with heart and soul. Now comes the problem. From verse 5 through 9. Moreover, you know also what Joab, the son of Zeruiah, did to me, and what he did to the two commanders of the armies of Israel, to Abner, the son of Ner, and Amasa, the son of Jether, whom he killed. And he shed the blood of war in peacetime, and put the blood of war on his belt that was around his waist, and on his sandals that were on his feet. Therefore, do according to your wisdom, and do not let his gray hair go down to the grave in peace. But show kindness to the sons of Barzillai the Gileadite, and let them be among those who eat at your table, for so they came to me when I fled from Absalom your brother. And see, you have with you Shimei the son of Gera, a Benjamite from Bahurim, who cursed me with a malicious curse in the day when I went to Mahanaim. But he came down to meet me at the Jordan, and I swore to him by the Lord, saying, I will not put you to death with the sword. Now, therefore, do not hold him guiltless, for you are a wise man and know what you ought to do to him. But bring his gray hair down to the grave with blood. That's the problem. Let's look at it in order. First of all, Joab. Joab was the general, the ex-general now. He had murdered two other men, Abner, who was actually a relative, and Amasa, who was also a relative. He murdered them both in peacetime. David had been unable to punish Joab. In the first case, when he murdered Abner, it is because David had just newly become king, And he was still weak. He says, this day I am weak, though I am anointed king. But the second one was because of his guilt. It was a moral inability when Joab murdered Amasa. If David had turned around to Joab and said, all right, you deserve to be executed for murdering Amasa, Joab will say, what about that letter you sent with Uriah the Hittite? The man carried his own death warrant in his hand when he carried that letter from you to me, because in that letter it was written, Joab, put Uriah in the front of the battle where he can get killed so that I can have his wife Bathsheba. David's inability in the second case was a moral inability. In both cases, he was unable to deal with Joab and to punish him. The principle for us is, keep a clear conscience. Keep your conscience clean. An accusing conscience is like hell on earth. Keep your conscience clean, because if we turn around and say something against an evil action, people can turn around and say, speak for yourself. They can point the finger right back at us. Some people, one person in particular I know, he's actually George Birch. His name is George Birch. He spoke to us at a meeting and told us about his ministry in casting out demons. He said on one occasion there was something on his conscience and the demons mocked him and refused to obey his command to leave the demon-possessed person. He said, I had to go home, I had to straighten it out with God, and then my power returned. How important it is, if we are going to lift up our face to God, to have a clean heart, clean hands, as the Psalms puts it, a clear conscience. Alas, David was not able. But he says also, with every new king, it is also a time of reckoning, a time of reformation, and a time of rewards. And therefore Solomon was legitimately qualified to deal with this bloodthirsty man, this murderer. Do not let his gray hair go down to the grave in peace. And Solomon had a handle on Joab, because Joab had aided Adonijah's treason. Adonijah had committed treason against Solomon, and Joab had been his henchman, his right-hand man. Solomon had a right to go after Joab. But he also mentions the sons of Barzillai. Here's a bright spot in his instructions in verse 7, Barzillai the Gileadite. Barzillai had helped David when David was running away from his son Absalom. At the risk of his life, Barzillai provided for David and his soldiers. He gave them food and clothes and beds and basins to wash in, etc. And so David said, show kindness to his sons, because he showed kindness to me. Mephibosheth is not mentioned. It's not that David forgot about Mephibosheth, but David had a lasting rule concerning Mephibosheth. For the rest of his life, Mephibosheth shall eat at my table. He shall be like one of the king's sons. That remained unchanged, so it needed no mention. But now comes the coward and the bully, Shimei. Shimei, the son of Gera, verse 8, a Benjamite from Bahurim, who cursed me with a malicious curse. On the way back, after David had defeated the rebels, David was returning in victory. Shimei came all fawning and groveling before King David. Please forgive me. I know that I did wrong, but I do ask your forgiveness. You see, I've come to be the first one to welcome you home. What do you do with a hypocrite? Give him time, give him enough rope, he'll hang himself. Sooner or later, his character will appear. David said, I swore to him by the Lord, saying, I will not put you to death with the sword. David renounced his personal right. But David was not only a private person, he was a public person. And the law of Moses says that when someone commits someone curses the king or someone in authority, they deserve the death penalty. And David was saying he still has to account for his public crime of cursing the king, whoever that king might be. Here's what one wise old writer put, how one wise old writer answered this whole problem of private and public injustice. Is it consistent to forgive others and still to seek to get satisfaction from the law for their offenses they have committed against us? The answer is yes. You can forgive them, but you can still prosecute them. Certainly one law does not cross another. By the law of charity, the law of justice is not made void. A magistrate, though he is a Christian and bound to forgive others, is not bound up from executing his office against public offenders. So if someone insults a judge, the judge can forgive the personal insult, but he must still honor the law, which says that that person is in contempt, and therefore he must be sentenced for contempt of court. You see the difference. This writer goes on to say, nor yet are private men tied from going to the magistrate for the restoration of their right or reparation of their wrong. To demand one's right is not contrary to love, nor to seek to amend and humble the guilty party by the magistrate's authority, who is the minister of God for good. Forgiving is an act of private jurisdiction. The offense, as far as it is private to us, it may be forgiven. But there are many such offenses as are not only an offense to us, but to the public order. And that must be left to the process of law. Now there's a wise, godly man giving us the correct perspective on it all. But he goes on to say, whoever uses this remedy must look to his own heart, that he is not being motivated by private revenge, nor with a spirit of rancor against the offending party. And furthermore, these remedies from authority must be in weighty cases and in matters of importance, not for every trivial thing. That's what David was doing. Some people charged David with injustice, with duplicity, with going back on his oath. No way. David renounced his personal right. I will not put you to death with the sword. But still, Shimei was guilty of a public offense that merited the death penalty. And so he says here, bring down verse 9. Now therefore do not hold him guiltless, for you are a wise man and know what you ought to do, but bring his gray hair down to the grave with blood. Given opportunity, we'll see, God willing, next week, Shimei proved that he was worthy of the death penalty. But for now, we'll have to leave it at David's dying charge, and we read in verse 10, so David rested with his fathers and was buried in the city of David. Judgment on the offense is compatible with the forgiveness of the offender.